In this week's episode, we want to know about how to look after a spacesuit once it's retired.
We're joined by Lisa Young, who works for the Smithsonian and was the key person in restoring Neil Armstrong's Apollo 11 spacesuit.
We love hearing from you. Let us know your thoughts via our social media pages at Space and Things Podcast on Threads, Instagram, and Facebook, or via the contact form on our website.
And please consider joining us on patreon.com/spaceandthings. But right now, it's time for episode 190 of the Space and Things Podcast.
This is the Space and Things Podcast with Emily Carney and Dave Giles.
I'm Emily Carney.
And I'm Dave Giles, and welcome to episode 190 of our podcast. How are you doing, Emily?
I'm doing good. I had a good weekend. I went to Shuttle Fest in Titusville this weekend. It was great. It was run by the great folks at the American Space Museum in Titusville.
Great place.
I had a great time. It was a lot of fun. I got to see a lot of really cool lectures. They were all really good, but the lectures I really enjoyed, there was one on Shuttle Centaur that was amazing, and there was one on space art, which had a lot of big space artists and photographers on it. So it was excellent, and I can't wait to go next year. So that's what I did over the weekend. So how are you, Dave?
Yeah, not too bad. In the middle of a house move, which finishes the end of this week. So I'm all over the place, but yeah.
Yeah, a little stressful. I understand.
Yeah, yeah. There's things everywhere. I don't know where anything is, all that kind of stuff. It's a bit crazy. Not much sleep.
Yeah.
But we're getting there. Anyway, shall we crack on with this week's main feature?
Yes.
I've mentioned this many times, but my favorite items to go and hunt out in museums are the spacesuits, especially the Apollo spacesuits, which are the A7L spacesuits, as they are named. I do like all spacesuits, but particularly those spacesuits. And while we were in Washington, D.C. in January, we were given a tour of the laboratory where they store all spacesuits at the Advar Hazy Center by Lisa Young. While we didn't have time to interview her on that trip, we did arrange a Zoom call, which meant we could have this chat now.
Lisa Young is a supervisory conservator at the National Air and Space Museum and has worked with the conservation unit since 1999. She has a BA in anthropology, historic preservation from the University of Mary Washington, a BSc Honours and Museum Conservation from the University of Wales, Cardiff, and is a PhD candidate at Durham University, United Kingdom, 2022. She currently leads a team of conservators working on treatment of objects scheduled for exhibition related to the renovation of 23 galleries at the museum. She has conducted primary research on the degradation, preservation, and display of spacesuits and related history objects. She served as conservation lead to Save America's Treasures project in 1999 and the Smithsonian's Kickstarter campaign to return Neil Armstrong's Apollo 11 spacesuit to display in 2019. She has performed treatment and research on Mercury, Gemini, and Apollo spacecraft in the collection and traveled with the Apollo 11 Command Module Destination Moon Show for 3 years. She has advised on the preservation, transport, and display of aerospace objects. She has displayed her work at numerous national and international conferences and has published written articles, contributions to books, blogs, and technical reports on these topics.
Yeah, this was one of my favorite interviews, as I'm sure you can appreciate. So I hope that you, as our listeners, also enjoy it.
Where space cracks on, this is Space and Things.
Welcome, Lisa, and thank you for joining us on Space and Things. First things first, how did you get into the world of spacecraft and spacesuit conservation? Was there always an interest in spaceflight, or was it more of an interest in material conservation?
So as part of my conservation program and any degree program in conservation, you're required to do an internship. And I chose the National Air and Space Museum for a variety of reasons. It was close to home. I had grown up in the military and around the D.C. area and frequented visiting the Smithsonian and the Air and Space Museum many times, so was interested in the collection. But more so, I had started my career in archaeological conservation. And with that, people were struggling to find ways to preserve rubber. And I knew the collection had a lot of rubber. I wanted to look at the materials and sort of tied sort of my interest personally, but also with my conservation training. So I chose Air and Space as an intern in the mid-1990s and have been here ever since.
That is awesome. Okay, that is cool. So your most publicly visible project has probably been the effort to preserve Neil Armstrong's spacesuit that flew during Apollo 11, which is beautifully displayed, as Dave and I saw at the National Air and Space Museum. So tell us about the challenges and the rewards of working to preserve and tastefully display such an iconic piece of not just space history, but really human history.
So first, the challenges. During some of my early research efforts on the spacesuit collection, the curators chose to remove that spacesuit from display in 2006. We knew that we needed to create better standards for spacesuit display in order to keep them on display longer and ensure that they were preserved. So we, for years before the public Kickstarter and the anniversary to investigate that suit, the challenges of putting it back on display and what that would take. When we did the public Kickstarter, it sort of catalyzed what we always wanted to do and ensured that we sort of had an internal deadline for ourselves of July 2019, we wanted it back on display, and so did the public. So after 13 years of research, treatment, investigation, and just sort of documentation on the suit, we wanted to return it to display. But one of the biggest challenges for me is making sure that the public really appreciates the way we display them. So in saying that, you know, the best thing for a spacesuit is to be, you know, in a very inert environment, climate controlled with very stringent recommended temperature and humidity, making sure that everything stays stable. But also we found over time that removing the gloves and helmets from the suits were beneficial to the preservation. But for Neil Armstrong's spacesuit, we knew that putting it back on display meant that the public would want to see the gloves and helmets back on the suit. So we had to look for a way to devise a mannequin system that would not only support the spacesuit over a long period of time, but allow for the gloves and helmets to be positioned on the suit, but not connected back on the suit. So as a spacesuit person, and I'm sure you're familiar with, they're fastened with disconnects to the actual spacesuit. So we didn't want to lock them back in, but we wanted to have them positioned so when the public saw the spacesuit, they could envision Neil Armstrong taking the first step on the moon and creating sort of a perception to the public that the spacesuit was completed.
Amazing. You mentioned there about investigation into the suit. How does that all work? Are you making x-rays of the suits or things like that? What are you using to investigate the suits?
Yeah, so a lot of it, the documentation doesn't exist from the time that they created them, used them, and then did the post-flight testing. So we've had to gather a lot of post-documentation from NASA and also from International LATEX and the people who created the suits. So a lot of that is historical research combined with looking at the suit and looking at the marks and abrasions and scratch marks on the different surfaces. How did they occur? Are they part of the history? Would we then preserve them or would we fix them as part of the preservation? But unlike most of our other artifacts, we can't take spacesuits apart. They're adhered and mechanically fastened together. And sometimes the history is even ingrained in that sort of wear that you see in the different layers. So we do use x-radiography, as you mentioned, to look inside the different layers of the suits. There's 21 layers in the A7L suit. We use CAT scanning. We use different types of material and analytical equipment to look at the exterior of the suit. We've looked at how far the lunar dust has gone into the layers of the spacesuit. Wow. And sort of anything that would impact its, you know, long-term preservation as a museum object, but also we can record right now in case that disappears, and we're not hoping it won't, anything about the suit that earmarks its history on the lunar surface.
Fantastic. So we've had a question from one of our Patreon subscribers, Jen Jones, which is relevant here. So we're going to ask this one. She said, what are the differences or the perhaps the pros and cons of restoration versus conservation? Is all of this type of work a mixture of both? She said it must be difficult when a lot of the items for the type of work have older, perhaps less detailed or no records, as you said.
Yeah, that's a great question, because in the conservation profession, we rarely do restoration. Restoration is when we make something look new or we replace original parts, by definition. However, at NASAM, we have a unique group of people who participate in restoration and conservation on many of our aircraft, and we use the term preservation. So preservation would apply to all aspects of conservation and restoration. For spacesuits, we don't do restoration. Right. The only time we have, and we've never replaced a part that I know of, but any time we've done any kind of repair is because we need it to be physically stable. So there was a suit in the past where they replaced the cover layer in consult with NASA. Right. I don't remember which suit that was, but that was because NASA needed part of the suit to test. And post-flight, it wasn't available. And in order to show it to the public early on, and we haven't done this recently, but early on and in the museum field career of the suit, the team at NASAM did consult with NASA to replace the cover layer. But more so, restoration at our museum would apply to aircraft, spacecraft. I worked on the command module project, Apollo 11. We still didn't do any restoration that I would consider true restoration in the sense of replacement, but we did structurally stabilize materials. So it traveled during a temporary display and then could be put on exhibit.
Right. So there are 12 suits that walked on the moon. And I'm fairly sure right now that only 4 of them are on display. So how do the other suits get stored? I have an image in my head of a room like a morgue with drawers that you pull out of the walls with the different suits in. Is that how it is? And are there plans to get all of the suits preserved like the Armstrong suit has done? Or have them displayed in cases around America, perhaps? Or is the plan to just rotate a few of them in order to keep them off display and last longer?
Well, you have a good vision. It is pretty much like a morgue, and it is cool. So our spacesuit vault that's at the Udvar-Hazy Center now has the entire collection of spacesuits. And wow. Even though you've only asked about the 12 primary lunar suits, we have 180 suits or more in the collection because we have all the prototypes, engineering models, backup suits, training suits. They're just as important. So we store them all at a very tight temperature and relative humidity. And also we have a lot of ventilation in the space because the materials continue to off gas. And so they're covered up with these muslin cotton covers that we use mostly for dust control on the shelves. They're not drawers, but they're an open sort of racking that moves together and you can move them apart because we call this condensed storage space in museum world because we need to put as many things as possible in one small space. And so the covers collect some of that off-gassing, which is nice because we can continue to monitor that and also replace them as a way to sort of scavenge that away from the suit. But they do pretty much look like bodies laying on shelves when you go in there, and some people have been frightened by it. But to answer your question, the suits really are becoming fragile with age, and we really do need to rotate them off display. We are looking at the collection right now and working with our lenders and also our own museum to provide better ways to display them. And I think in the future, we'll probably have shorter term loans for suits, then also rotate them within our own museum. But it's just a matter of resources and how much we can put towards doing that and rotating them on and off display.
Yeah, but before Emily asks the next question, you used a term there twice. Off-gassing, which I'm familiar with, which I just want, for those perhaps who don't know much about these processes, what does that mean and why is it bad for the suits?
So that's a term that I'm just using to describe plastics. And as they age, the plastics are releasing chemicals, not just plastics in the sense of hard plastics, but soft fabrics that are made from plastics, but more the chemical term would be polymers. Right. So all of the spacesuits are made of synthetic materials. Only the rubber bladder is combined with a natural rubber called latex. But most of the other materials do age by releasing sort of a chemical. And when that's released, you don't want it sitting next to the other materials or the spacesuit or within that environment. So we try to ventilate and pull those gases away from the spacesuit so that it doesn't cause more deterioration.
So you've also worked to preserve Soviet and Russian spacesuits. So tell us about the differences in safeguarding them and how they're designed much differently from U.S. suits?
I haven't done too many. We do have two Sokol suits in the collection. One was on loan and one is in our collection. And those are the launch and reentry suits they use in the program still today. The materials are a little bit different. They're guarded, so I don't know the materials exactly. They are synthetics.
Wow.
You don't see the same problems you do with the U.S. suits because they didn't do a combination of the rubber product. So the rubber is more like, if you can picture those sort of baby blankets that are flocked on one side and then rubberized on the other side. So they're very soft, natural, I think latex rubber or a polyurethane suede rubber looking material. It's hard to tell. We haven't done much analysis on them, but they tend to stay soft and pliable. And the way it was described to me that you get in a spacesuit of that sort by Katie Coleman herself, who has worn them. It's sort of like putting on a kayak where you like dive into the suit and sort of bring the suit around you. And then you tie this rubber bladder around yourself and sort of create a knot and then hope for the best.
Wow.
It's a very simple method, but it works. I don't think there's been any failures in those suits, but the materials are just a bit different than the American suits. But the outer materials, there's also some sort of plasticizer, as we just talked about, in the outer Lycra layer. You see this on the arms and the legs. It's sort of a soft material that looks like it's used for sizing. That's discoloring over time, sort of uniformly across those suits. Still not sure exactly why, materiality-wise. Like, we haven't done any analysis on it, but we do know that it has some sort of elastomer material in there.
Fantastic. Obviously, there's been a lot of talk about new spacesuits recently, with the Artemis program going back and also being a shortage of spacesuits and different companies bid in to be the provider of spacesuits. Do they reach out to you and ask about what happened to the old suits in terms of things they might want to be aware of while they're designing them to help them? How often do you have to say no?
Well, we're a museum, so we're there to share and to educate people. And, you know, the funny thing is, like, the people who built the Apollo spacesuits are no longer with us, unfortunately. Yeah. A lot of them have reached the age where they're either not here or their memories are failing. And, you know, when I first came into this project in the 90s, you know, it was easy to talk to those people and call them up or have them come by and look at the suits and give us information. And I think the new engineers for these other companies are probably facing that same, you know, those same questions. Like, they're working on problems and trying to problem solve and think about what they would do when they go back to the moon and build their spacesuit, but they have not seen the examples from Apollo. So we are there to share. We have met with a few people, and I will provide information if they call us, always officially through the museum. But, you know, we are there to share our experiences and point them in the direction of either scholarly research that's been done on the spacesuits that we have. We've partnered with NASA on several occasions to study the lunar dust on the suits. And those are on the NASA technical server for anyone to see. We just have to know that they're there to get them and to make sure that we share that information in our experiences. When we were doing the command module project, we had a lot of people come back because Apollo 11, for the first time in many decades, was available as a research tool. And same with shuttle. People have come back and looked at our space shuttle from NASA to look at parts or to measure things. You know, that's part of the agreement, is that we're preserving this space legacy, but it's not just for us. You know, it's for the public first and foremost, but also to keep it available to people who continue with space flight and human space flight.
So, as we just talked about, you've also added working on spacecraft to your extensive work. So many vintage spacecraft are missing essential pieces and parts because NASA, they frankly remove them following their missions. How do you balance that with keeping hardware looking, you know, as period accurate as possible?
So the only thing I can speak to in my own experiences with Apollo 11, I know that there was a data plate and some items that were taken out when it was post-processed after the lunar mission and are probably out there in either collectors' hands or have resurfaced at other museums. Most of that goes through the curators at our museum to decide if they're going to recall or ask for these items back and then re-implement them back into the actual artifact that we have. My job as a conservator, and the way I look at it personally, is that I'm preserving whatever's in front of me. So I'm not trying to add to or take away from the object. I'm trying to understand it and add to its history, but I don't have to make that decision, fortunately, as to what I would do if somebody appeared with, you know, a piece of the command module. Our command module, for instance, is that typical brown resin color that you see, the resin that they apply to the outside of the heat shield. And when I say heat shield, there's the ablative heat shield on the bottom and then the mid heat shield, which is the body of the spacecraft. That was covered in gold Kapton tape. And when it came through reentry, if you look at the pictures, you don't see that color. You see the gold Kapton tape and then even the burn marks from reentry. Mm. Well, that was peeled off when it was post-processed. And we know people have little pieces of this foil in Kapton, right? So I don't know that they would ever bring these little pieces back to us, but you know, we do look to those people when they ask us questions or these things resurface for to add information to our history, right? So even if we didn't take them back, we try to work together with people to inform the entire historical record of an artifact we have.
That would be quite the jigsaw puzzle, trying to put all the bits of Kapton foil back on a command module.
Yeah, and then how do you know it's even authentic, right?
Yeah,
I mean,
exactly.
Sometimes these things show up, and they say they're from that spacecraft, but you don't know because it could be from any spacecraft. So
yeah, there's bits of heat shield floating around as well that everyone always says is from spacecraft as well, don't they?
Yeah, that's a whole other discussion.
Yeah, I'm sure.
So what are you currently working on that you can discuss? And which things do you think will pose the most significant concern in future artifact preservation?
So right now we're working on the transformation of our museum. You guys got to visit the first eight mm-hmm. galleries that are open, but we have 13 more galleries to go, which we're hoping to open by the 50th anniversary in 2026. So there are 12 more spacesuits scheduled for what I'm terming the rest of the building, which is the east end side, which is exciting. We have some of our hard suits that we're putting on display, which is fun because we've had a hard suit on display before, but not recently. We just finished making the mannequin for Gagarin's training suit, which will go back on display.
Nice.
It is on loan from a lender to our museum, and it was on display previously, but we had a bit of work to do to get it into a new mannequin system and sort of make it look a little bit more respectful. The cover layer is sort of floppy and, you know, the materials are stretched over time and things, but we wanted to make that look better. We do have some incoming loans of spacesuits from other companies. That's all I'll say, that have been going up in space.
Oh, nice.
I don't know how many I can talk about here, but some exciting ones, including by female astronauts, which will be nice to see on display.
Yes.
We will be displaying David Newman's compression suit in one of our new galleries. So I know you guys have seen that, and that's been on display at the Smithsonian in a future show that was at the Arts and Industries building. I think that closed last year. And we're very interested in showcasing her work that she's done. And then in the At Home in Space Gallery, which was the shuttle gallery before called Moving Beyond Earth, which has been redesigned and is going to be new. We're going to have the launch and reentry suit from shuttle, the pumpkin suit, back on display.
Nice.
We'll have Guy Bluford and Sally Ride's in-flight garments from shuttle on display, which is really special. And then Shannon Lucid's penguin suit. It's her exercising suit that was used in shuttle. A lot of people haven't seen these early suits before they created exercise equipment on the International Space Station, where they would, this particular suit has pulleys and things in it where they would be able to exercise in their space garments.
Amazing.
So there is a chance that we're getting other suits for the museum, but the curators are working on those projects right now. So we're really excited. This will be a lot for us to do, and they're all going to be displayed a little bit differently and tell a different story, but they'll be across three galleries, so that will be fun.
That's fantastic. All right, when you're building a mannequin for a spacesuit, do you give the mannequin a name?
No one's ever asked me that. I have never given them a name. It's a lot of work. So by the end, I think I just want to, you know, kind of like kill them myself. we do try to, we do refer to the suits by their names, which is odd, you know, like Armstrong suit and refer to it as he when we're making things. But yeah. I have not given any mannequins names.
Yet. Maybe you will now.
Yeah, maybe I will. Yeah.
one final question from me. When something gets sent in to you, or when the curators find a new piece and say, Lisa, we've got this thing and it's going to need some work, what items are the ones that really get you excited? Or perhaps when they're bringing something back in that's been out on display for a while. I was just thinking when we were there, we were looking over at the restoration hangar, which you can see in the public gallery, and the X-15 was there, for example. I'm not sure if you've worked on that, but just when something comes back into that hangar, is there a particular type of item where you're like, yes, I need to be working on that?
Yeah. I mean, for me, it's the earlier spacecraft. I really love the Mercury and Gemini spacecraft because you don't see that many of them. Yeah. I did have the privilege of working on Gemini 4 and Friendship 7.
Nice.
And Apollo 11, so I call that the trifecta.
Yes.
I think I like working on spacecraft more because I don't know as much about them as spacesuits. So for me, it's a very big learning curve still. And there's so many things about them that are different between the different missions. And the cool thing about them is it really makes you think about why the spacesuits are a certain way, because they had to integrate with the spacecraft to keep an astronaut alive in space. So they're very much tied together, which I never sort of considered when I was working on the artifacts separately. I think for me, though, like I get really excited about the personal items. So I don't know if you all saw in the Destination Moon Gallery downtown, there's the fender that Gene Cernan brought back.
Yes.
That he created out of his map cover on the moon. For me, something like that, certainly very personal to the astronaut and the story of the mission, and something that was not planned by NASA for them to do. I mean, those are super cool artifacts because technologically there's no design for them, right? So
yeah.
We have the only example of what happened. I love those. I love those type of stories and collections. But yeah, the spacecraft I've become very interested in. But I did get to work on the X-15, which was super cool.
Oh, amazing.
With my team. And and I did sort of assign myself to it because I decided it was a space plane, which was nice.
Fantastic. Well, thank you so much for joining us. This is an interview that I've been hoping we could do for a very, very, very long time. That, as Emily said, and as you've alluded to, we did get to go to the Downtown Museum and Aardvark-Hazy. And that Armstrong suit and the whole of the Destiny exhibit is so beautiful. And I'm really looking forward to what's going to come with those new exhibits. And good work with everything you've done, because it's really is so special.
Well, thank you. I'm so glad you guys could see the lab and behind the scenes and sort of picture that before we got to talk. And I welcome you back anytime. We love to hear feedback on the exhibits. I mean, that's what makes our jobs worthwhile, is for us to get feedback on them. So
fantastic. Well, I hope we can go in the morgue next time.
The morgue.
Do you ever forget that we're actually all traveling through space on a big spaceship? Me too. This is Space and Things.
Long-time listeners will know this is obviously a subject very close to my heart. And in my opinion, Lisa has an amazing job.
Yes.
Just amazing having access to those suits and being able to study them, x-ray them, be with them. Must be a lot of fun. But also the job she is doing is so important.
And oh, yeah.
They spent so much money on those. Let's focus mainly on the Apollo stuff. Obviously, we know there's other suits that they've got and spacecraft that Lisa gets to work with. But let's focus on the suits, because they're such incredible pieces of engineering. And they tell such an amazing story. There's so many different facets into how they got to that design. And why they ended up that design and how the astronauts were involved in helping to shape the design by saying what works, what doesn't work, and, and what they wanted. And there's so many lessons to be learned from them, which we can take forward. And so these really are important historical documents in terms of where the future of spaceflight is going to go. So the idea of looking after these things and making sure that they're preserved as long as possible is so important. And personally, I think it's great that someone like Lisa is there. What's interesting is she said she's been there a while now, which is fascinating, but also so important to have someone that has been there, and there is that continuity between changes of other people coming in and out of the museum, other curators perhaps changing, to have someone who's looking after this stuff, who's there for a long period of time, is so important in terms of helping these things last as long as possible and having someone with that expertise. And it must be quite difficult for the museum to keep hold of someone like that, who I'm sure is in demand in other areas of history. You know, she has an archaeological background. It must be, someone must be saying, oh, she knows a lot about off-gassing. She's the expert on those spacesuits.
Yeah.
Maybe she can offer some, it's not to say there's not other people who are experts at it, but she is proven with some of the most valuable and historical assets of recent history that she is exceptionally good at this stuff and really knows her stuff and respects the items. And I think that's so valuable to have around. So it was great to talk to her. It was great to go. We were lucky, weren't we? Because we actually got to go and hang out with her before we interviewed her a few months ago, which doesn't get to happen, really. We don't do that very often, do we?
Yeah.
Well, I mean, never.
I don't think we've ever done that before. She needs to be like a superstar or something like that. Yeah. Like, she needs more visibility, because what she's doing, as you said, it really is contributing to the future of spaceflight, because the Apollo suits are the only deep space spacesuits that have been out there. And she has all the knowledge on them, you know, and how they degrade over time. She probably has a lot of insight into how modern suits could be made a little bit better.
Yeah.
Not just so they, what's the word I'm searching for? Maybe wear better over time, but also maybe how they could be better for the astronaut as well, you know, because I'm sure the A7L suits were tested a million times. I'm sure there were things that the astronauts were like, man, this could be a little easier. And I think, and that's important, you know, as nowadays, you know, we're talking about going back to the moon with Artemis and probably other programs or even perhaps further out than the moon. But I feel like Lisa just does not get enough flowers. Like, she needs to be a superstar or something like that, because I'm serious, because I'm absolutely serious. She's very modest, I think. She doesn't put herself out like I'm a superstar, but she needs to be one, because what she's doing is just vital on many levels, I think. Because of her, we're learning how maybe spacesuits should be in the future for deep space exploration. That is a big deal.
Absolutely. But there's a few aspects of that as well, because it's not only are we learning in terms of people thinking about making these suits for the future, but as she said, it's that balance of, okay, we also have to display the suits in a way that's going to connect with the public. And the way that they have figured out a way of displaying Neil's suit where the helmet and the gloves can look like they're on it but they're not on it is amazing.
If you go see it, Dave and I have seen it, but if you go see it, it does look like they're connected. It really does. You won't notice anything like, oh, it doesn't look right. You're not going to notice anything. It looks very like it did when he walked on the moon. You know, it's amazing how they did that. And it's also amazing, I think, how they stored it while displaying it. You know, they have it ventilated so that any off-gassing, that effect is minimized. I was thinking about that when I'm looking at the suit. I'm like, well, how are they tackling that while it's displayed? And then they explained it to me and I was like, oh, of course. Okay, not that I was thinking, you know, oh, I've solved the problem, something like that. But at the same time, I was thinking about it, because I'm like, I'm sure this emits some kind of gas over time. And nope, they have it all figured out. And it's ventilated in such a way that it minimizes damage to the suit. And I was like, they've thought about everything in preserving these suits. I mean, they have it all nailed down. And it's just, it's amazing.
Yeah, absolutely. And the other thing that while you were talking earlier about the future and how preserving these suits is so important, and it is, it also made me think of the fact that when these were built, when these A7L suits were built, especially built with the idea of going to walk on the moon, there were so many unknowns. No one really knew what regolith was or was going to do, how it was going to react with materials. I mean, there were some outlandish ideas that it was cheese, or that it was going to blow up the moment it comes in contact with anything, or it was quicksand. No one really knew what they were expecting, especially those first two. I, as far as I'm aware, there wasn't many changes made to that suit through the program.
Yeah, I don't think so.
I don't recall seeing anything, not drastic changes. So the way they designed those suits, for an unknown to have been that durable in that process to get those astronauts home safely off the moon, is incredible. And yes, as a result of the fact that you can now see how that regolith has reacted to the suit, and we've got x-rays and other data about how this is all panned out and how many layers.
We know more now.
We know more. So there's so many things you can use, so many bits of data that we can use for future spacesuits, not just in terms of to help them last longer and be more durable and protect the astronauts even better than these ones did, but also so that they can be more useful for the astronauts. That's got to be the most important thing, right? So you want someone in there who isn't going to come back like Dave Scott did, where his fingernails were
black. My cup.
Yeah.
You can't see it. For those of you just listening, my fingernails are like a bluish, I have a painted and they're bluish, like a black color.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure that if Emily looked on the bottle of the nail varnish she has used,
Dave Scott.
The color is called Dave Scott's nails.
Dave Scott's nails. Yeah. Yeah. No, it's funny. I was thinking about that when you were talking earlier. I was thinking about his nails because I think he was trying to tighten his glove up.
Yeah, he had a glove that was too small for his hand. So he went with a size lower than it should have done in order for him to really feel like he could pick up things and have as much maneuverability as he possibly could. But the downside was it was excruciating for him.
Yeah.
But he did it anyway, which is just crazy.
I think he hurt his shoulder too, like he strained it or something like that, because I read his book and I was like, this guy was wild. Like, he literally was like, I'm going to do whatever I have to. I'm like, oh my God. But exactly. Stuff like that, maybe there's a way they could design gloves better so people have better dexterity, or they feel they have better dexterity so they have more of a sort of a touch, a better touch feeling, I guess.
Yeah,
like you're actually grabbing onto something versus I'm grabbing onto something through like a glove box or something. I've worked in a glove box in my life and a long time ago, and it's frustrating. You feel like you're not touching anything.
I have a story to tell you. I may have shared this on the podcast before. When I was visiting all the museums in 2019, I was up in the one in Cleveland, which the name escapes me right now, but it's where one of the Skylab command modules are.
Oh, so okay.
You should go. The Great Lakes Science Center, maybe?
Yeah.
It's in the building next to the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. Anyway, I was in there and it was a quiet day. There wasn't many people there. It was midweek, and I walked into one of the rooms all on my own. And they had this box where you could put your hands into the gloves and then you could do some activities, right? And now it didn't say it was for children, but I think it may have been for children.
No.
Now, of course, I'm a big guy, 6'5", my hands are quite big. So I go, oh yeah, I'll have a go at that. Put my hand in, have a little play, and then I'm standing there,
you're
no
stuck.
One's around, and I'm like, I can't get my hand out.
Oh my God.
Now, I'm sure it's going to come out eventually, but have I just broken the exhibit? Fortunately, somehow I did a little maneuver and it just slid out.
It was
all okay, but there was a moment where I was like, am I stuck here? Is anyone going to walk in eventually? And it was a good 5 to 10 minutes for me, but I'm guessing on the camera, because I didn't look like I was panicking. They may have just looked at him going, he's really enjoying his time with his hand in that... He's really enjoying himself. Whereas really, I'm thinking, I am stuck.
Oh,
I'm
stuck.
And if they're going to get me out, I've broken something that might be
their exhibit.
Luckily, it didn't break. And, and my hands survived. So we were all right. But yes, it was funny. I saw the as soon as I got my hand out, I saw the funny side of it. Even while it was going, I was like, "This is."
I think I got my hand. I don't have a big hand. I have a little elst hand, and I think one time I got it stuck in a tin. This sounds very British. I had a tin, and it actually had tea bags in it because hot tea sometimes. And I stuck my hand in it, and it got stuck for a little while. And I got it out, but it was bleeding and. Somewhat. This was years ago.
Oh my god!
Last time I ever did that. So because I was like, I have a small hand. Whoop! And then I was like, oh god, I can't get it out.
Yeah, Jesus. Get the tin opener.
Yeah. Your story is better because it was in a public place. I was at home, so the embarrassment was located at just at home. I was like, oh my god.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Anyway, this was a great interview. I thoroughly enjoyed talking to Lisa. I think the work she's doing is amazing. And I hope everyone at home really enjoyed it as well. If you're ever now at any museum that has a spacesuit on display, have some respect for what that's gone through.
Yes.
Not just while it was in space, but since it got back and what they're doing to try and tell the story of those suits. Because I always feel like when the suits are on display in the museum, sometimes they get overlooked a little bit. And you shouldn't do, because they're fascinating. The very fact that we're able to even see them is really cool.
They're not just space suits, but to me, they're spacecraft.
Oh, yeah. Well, absolutely.
They're spacecraft. They're just smaller. A lot smaller.
Yeah, for sure. All right. As always, the unedited video will be in the Patreon page. So just head over to patreon.com/spaceandthings if you want to watch us talking to Lisa. And if you want to find out more about her, check the show notes on spaceandthingspodcast.com or click the link in the description of this podcast on your podcast provider.
Please leave us a review or share our podcast with your space-loving friends. This is the Space and Things podcast.
So, Emily, what has caught your eye in spaceflight this week?
What caught my eye this week is an Ars Technica article. Of course, it'll be in our show notes. It's by Stephen Clark. NASA has said, and this is directly taken from the article, not my words, NASA says it needs better ideas on how to return samples from Mars. I believe yesterday there was a press conference talking about alternate methods to do a Mars sample return program. As we've discussed previously in this podcast, that program is sort of on the chopping block only because it's extremely expensive. I believe it would cost at this time $11 billion, several launches to do such a program. And the samples wouldn't be back until around 2040, which is that's a little ways out. To make a long story short, NASA and JPL did put across sort of alternate methods to do this kind of thing. However, they don't even like those. Bill Nelson, the NASA administrator, has said the current budget environment does not allow us to pursue an $11 billion architecture in 2040 is too long. So NASA and JPL has reached out to commercial and government, the private and some public sector people as well. They will release a solicitation as soon as this upcoming Tuesday for ideas to bring back Perseverance's samples. So that is something that is currently being looked at to mitigate the very high expense and, of course, the duration of what time it would take to bring back those Mars samples. This is a story that we are currently following, and we will bring updates on this podcast whenever we get them weekly. So this is something, as you may remember, we had Casey Dreyer of the Planetary Society, who is a policy analyst, on her show a few months ago, who really broke the issues with the Mars sample return mission down on our show. And it really helped a lot because I didn't quite understand a lot of that myself. So if you want to go back and listen to that, that's a great listen. So, Dave, what has caught your eye this week?
So I'd like to revisit a story that Emily has brought up a few times, and it is about Voyager 1. NASA have figured out what has caused the breakdown in communications between Earth and Voyager 1, which is currently on an interstellar voyage across the galaxy, I guess. Yes.
Yeah. The universe, no, left, I guess. I don't know.
It's left the solar system. It's still in the galaxy, right? Yeah, okay. Sorry,
I
told you I'm tired.
It's interstellar space. Yeah.
It's out there somewhere.
It's way out there.
It's out there.
Yeah, it's pretty far out there. I think it's okay to say universe at this point because, yeah, it's somewhere in the universe. Yeah,
it's a ways out there. Yes.
Yeah.
Well, essentially, it would appear that a small portion of corrupted memory exists in one of its computers. I don't know how they figure this out, but they have figured it out.
Yeah.
They're fairly confident that they're going to be able to figure out a workaround for this now. But they don't know whether it's broken because it got hit by something or whether it's just old. They don't know.
Yeah.
And they're never going to know, obviously. But yeah, it's certainly fun to think that we might be able to communicate with Voyager 1 again soon. And I just think this story is great. You know, as we've spoken about many times, it's been up there a long time and it's still sending back data.
Yeah.
Granted, it's been sending that back gobbledygook recently, but we might start getting some sense out of it again soon, which is good. I also like the fact that I think the technical term for what they tried to do, which made them realize that there was an issue, was poke the spacecraft. They call it, that's what they call it. We're just going to give it a little poke, which takes me back to Facebook around 2011, or the first few years of Facebook when we used to poke each other. I don't know why, but we used to do it anyway.
Yeah, so, I remember that.
Bring back poking.
Yeah.
Or not. Anyway, that's what's caught my eye. And of course, both those articles, or articles about both those stories, will exist in our show notes, which you can find on spaceandthingspodcast.com or by clicking on the link in the description of this podcast in your podcast provider.
This podcast supplies on the generosity of our members. To help out, you can sign up at patreon.com/spaceandthings.
Thanks for joining us this week, and thanks for all your support. We really do appreciate all of you being here. If you're new here, please go and check out the back catalogue of podcasts. You can find that full list on our website, spaceandthingspodcast.com, and it's got a little search function. If there's particular things you'd like, then you can have a look. We've had some incredible guests over the last 190 episodes since we started in 2020, and if you've enjoyed this week, I'm sure there are plenty of other episodes that you'll love.
And if you like this episode a lot or any of our previous episodes, please do share them with your friends. That would mean a lot to us. We'll be back with more Space and Things next week, but until then, don't forget, in space, no one can hear you mean.
Thank you for listening. New episodes every Thursday. This has been the Space and Things Podcast.